Hi, my name is Rocio, and I'm first-generation Dominican-American.
Hi, I'm Mercedes, and I am from Santo Domingo, República Dominicana.
And we are Amplifying the Afro in Afro-Caribbean.
Hey, Rocio.
Mercedes. What's up, my girl?
What's popping out in these streets? What are you up to?
Just trying to thrive out here as an artist, doing my thing. How you doing?
I'm good. Enjoying the bay and enjoying the weather, and really bummed that I didn't get to go to opening night for POTUS. It looked so fire.
Oh my God, I wish you were there, Mercedes. It was so dope. I walked my first red carpet. My mom was my date, so it was really cool that I got to introduce my mom to Vanessa Williams. I got the opportunity to do that, and that was amazing. And this show is off the hook. Like, if any listeners are in New York City right now, it is on till August. I highly recommend it, not just because I worked on the show, but legitimately, it is hilarious and just brings so much joy. I recommend anybody to go watch it. And just as a shout out, I have a really dear friend. Her name is Serafina Bush, and she was the costume designer on For Color Girls, Who Considered Ooh. Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough. That's also on Broadway. That is also fantastic. And she just got nominated for a Tony.
What? And you know what? We have to support theater. So listeners, if y'all thinking about a date or y'all want to go check out some shows, now's the time. Like, these actors, these writers, these creatives are putting their blood, sweat, and tears on the stage, and we have to support it. We have to keep theater alive. So please go check it out and support my girl.
Yeah, come check it out. Come check it out. But how you doing? How's that bay doing?
Oh, the bay is awesome, girl. It's just chilling. But girl, there's just so much going on right now. Like, I'm glad I get to kind of find my zen place here, because every time I like turn on the TV or the news, there's some crazy shit going on.
I know, for real. I mean, I have to say I'm happy. I haven't been able to, but I'm in Boston working right now, and there have been a lot of gatherings and protests about women's rights that I love seeing, and I really wish I could go. There's a part of me that like loves working, and a part of me that's like, oh, I just wish I had time to get out here on these streets and be like, bands off our bodies now. You know what I'm saying? Like, hashtag women's right to choose. Like, let's do this. I'm just really sad and taken back that this country is going backwards when we've made so much progress.
Yeah, it's very scary. I can't even fathom like thinking about Roe versus Wade being reversed.
I can't either.
And just, you know, what does that mean? Like, I saw this quote, someone said, it's just going to be safe abortions are not going to be allowed. People are still going to do what they need to do to choose what they want to do with their bodies. Yeah. And I don't think it means that everyone's just running to go get an abortion. Like, there's so many, it's just a delicate topic. Why are these old white men deciding what we do with our bodies?
Yeah, I agree. And I also like to point out to people that abortion isn't so black and white. There's so many different reasons why it happens. Like, if a woman gets a miscarriage,
yeah, that's considered an abortion.
That's an abortion, you know, and that's someone who's trying to have a baby. Like, they actually want to have
a
baby.
Or an ectopic, you know? Right? You have a baby that's not in the right space. It's at high risk for the mother. There's people mm-hmm. that think that, no, you have to take that risk. People that get raped. It's just a delicate, delicate conversation. And then you know what else? Because I'm reading a lot about adoptions, right? And foster care. Black and brown kids are the highest here in California that are in the foster care system. And so the aftermath of what's going on now, there's also going to be a bunch of kids that are born that they may not, their parents may have not been ready to have or may not be able to take care of, that are now going to probably go into the foster care system.
Yeah. Yeah, it's terrible. It's like so much. And it really is scary. And it's scary. I don't think I want children, but I just like the knowing in the back of my head that I'm going to get the care that I need if anything happens. And it's sad to think that that might not happen, that it me just going to an OBGYN might not be the safest place for me as a Black woman. And that really scares me too.
Yeah, it's so multi-layered. And then also, I was speaking to someone recently that they were like, well, that doesn't affect me, so it doesn't matter. I think that's also very dangerous as well. Like,
yeah,
because where that person is in their life with their partner, that they don't give a shit about what's going on. And I think that that's even more dangerous as well.
I think it's very dangerous too, because if you don't care, then when that kid robs you in 10 years, you're going to be real mad, you know?
Well, it doesn't mean necessarily the kid is going to become
a criminal. But I'm just saying, like, these things matter as a whole society.
Not just
you can't be selfish and be like, well, does it affect me? So whatever. Like, it does affect you because it affects like where you live, inflation. Like, it affects a lot of things, actually, where your taxpayer dollar goes. Like, it's way more multi-layered, and everyone should be involved in these things. I mean, I don't know. It's so complicated.
It's very complicated.
And you know what? We could get into this for like hours and hours and hours, but it does aggravate me that people could think that way, like it doesn't affect them.
And to keep it 100, in our own country, in Dominican Republic, that's a big issue, women's rights. And I know recently, well, a couple months ago, people were seriously marching for pro-life, and it's a very much pro-life country, like a lot of, you know, countries outside of the United States. And I understand, obviously, we want children. You don't want people abusing. It's not a form of birth control all the time. Like, people just going, I think people assume that that means people are just sitting there using it as a birth control method, or at 5 months pregnant, or crazy shit. Mm-hmm. But I just think about women in Dominican Republic as well, that it's a real thing there. Like, it's a real thing. I don't know. I'm just glad I'm not in my 20s anymore, let me tell you, or in my teens, because that's a scary time when you're trying to figure out a lot of things. Oh, and also, we can talk about this forever, but are they talking about, if they are so serious about this, are they talking about birth control? Because are we doing a campaign to encourage birth control or educate more on birth control? Because I think that there needs to be preventative measures.
Some states are also trying to take away birth control.
Yeah. And I heard they're trying to also in the future, I don't know if this is true, that this could affect IVF. This could affect a lot of different women's right to have children in different ways. So it's scary ass times.
Yeah, it's really scary. It's really scary.
Speaking of,
and it's also like working, you know, it's like we live in such this capitalist society where like women are having kids older because they need to have, I mean, the whole thought of being like a stay-at-home mom is, which I know a lot of women want to do, but like in this day and age, it's not even possible because you have to work to survive.
Yeah.
It's just getting rarer and rarer. And that's why women are having kids later and later, because they need to work. They need to have careers.
And like, I know you heard there's a baby formula shortage going on, apparently.
Yeah.
So like,
I mean, the irony of that, right?
Yeah, I know, right? It was weird too. But like, it's just, oh my gosh, it's so overwhelming. Well, the fact that even as a woman of color, when you go give birth, you're actually at risk because nobody gives a shit about you giving birth. And the studies have shown how we're so disregarded at times when it comes to pain. And so, you know, a woman risks her life to go have a child. And then now this whole situation with when they go back to work, there have to also the balance of just having a child, choosing if you want to breastfeed or if you can. Some women can't breastfeed.
Yeah.
Even if they want to. And so, it's so much going on.
Yeah, so much.
Now with work and now with, because of COVID, a lot of women I was reading were the ones that left corporate America or left jobs because of childcare issues.
Yeah, yep.
Because companies wanted women to just, okay, let's go back to work. But the schools were closed, right? Children were doing virtual learning and all of that. And that's why I think this whole great resignation thing, it's pretty great.
Yeah.
I think it's great. I think part of the greatness is just self-reflection and kind of thinking, you know what, like, is it worth it what I'm doing right now with this job or this situation? Am I in the right career? Mm-hmm. I think that's the one benefit of COVID.
Yep. It's crazy.
Like, I was reading some statistics and it said that one half of workers said higher pay was the top reason why they'd look for a job.
Mm-hmm.
44% of employees are job seekers, according to Willis Towers Watson 2022 Global Benefits Attitude Survey. And it's just interesting that, okay, and there's another statistic here. In the month of February, 4.4 million Americans quit their job.
Wow.
Yes.
4.4
million. Throughout 2021, an average of 3.8 million workers left their jobs every single month.
Oh my God.
Over 47 million Americans left their jobs by the end of 2021.
Wow.
So I think companies also need to be aware, if they want to retain their employees, they need to go back to HR and sit down and think and talk to their employees about what's happening. How can we make this a better environment? And I think it's putting the pressure on employers to step it up, or people are going to move and leave. Why do we need to stay there?
Exactly. Yeah.
And I kind of like that vibe.
Yeah. This whole myth of like, we could just find anyone to replace you is just not the thing. And it's just not the tea. It's not the tea.
Yeah. That's why I'm really excited about our guest and the conversation that we had with our guest.
Yeah, me too.
And full transparency, we did have this episode a couple months back. So there are some things in the episode that we do mention that happened maybe a couple months ago, right?
Yeah.
So, but it's exciting because this woman is amazing. And this kind of ties in with us, career changes and the great resignation. And I know some of our listeners may be going through some changes right now, might be sitting at work right now.
Yeah.
We just hope this episode gives you some encouragement, and it's a wonderful, wonderful episode.
Yeah. Should we introduce our guest?
Yeah. So our guest is pretty dope, just like all our guests. Her name is Catalina Peña, and she has her own company called Catalyst Creations. And so Catalina Peña is a 1.5 generation Afro-Latina entrepreneur. And let me just say, she is Colombian, which I think is dope that she identifies as an Afro-Latina. So we get to talk to that, which is really exciting because that's what we want to do for season two. And she helps Black and Brown professionals make their dreams career realities. She's worked in recruiting at Facebook, Twitter, Asana, tons of companies.
Yeah. And by using her recruiting background and trailblazer energy, she founded her company that we mentioned before, Catalyst Creation, in 2019 to continue helping diverse communities with their career needs to create lasting career confidence, abundant financial freedom, and a balanced approach to work life. So let's play this motherfucking episode.
Let's do it.
Hola, hola, hi, Catalina.
Hola, hola, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing really great, actually. I'm you know, really kind of living in this moment right now. So I'm really, really excited about being on here, about sharing my story, and like, you know, just the fact that we all got connected. I think it's really great.
Yes, yes. We're so happy that we connected. That was a great event that we did. You hosted a beautiful panel about Afro-Latinx podcasters, and it's been love ever since. It's been a whole love fest with
a
the
whole
other.
Love fest.
Yeah,
I love
whole
it. I
love,
love
fest. So let's get into it. Let's just dive deep.
Let's dive in.
Well, first of all, so people that don't know who you are, tell us about you.
Yeah, definitely. So I almost kind of hate this question always, but I am glad that you asked it because it forces me to really like kind of take a walk down memory lane. So who am I before? And then also, like, before I go into my journey, I do like to say that, you know, I'm most of all, like, I'm a light, I'm a connector, I'm a trailblazer. I identify with more of those, like, personas because that's what keeps me going in my journey. It's been really varied. It's been, you know, just a lot of things that have happened. And so those three things really help me come back to myself no matter where I am. Nice. And so with that said, you know, kind of how everything started and like what I'm doing now, I'm a career coach and I own my own professional development company, Catalyst Creation, and I help Black and Brown folks make their dreams career realities. And what I mean by that is really empower them to understand that they have a choice and agency, full agency, in choosing their careers that's going to make them happy, choosing a job that's actually going to support them, choosing themselves over a job and making their work for them, because that goes against, I think, what a lot of us were taught, that we have to go into a workplace and actually, you know, work to the bone and, you know, kind of give up part of ourselves in order to make it work. And so that's kind of why I do all of that. Kind of in retrospect, to kind of talk to a little bit about my journey, I'm a 1.5 generation immigrant. For those of you who don't know what that is that I came here when I was 9. So my mom and my sister came with me and we didn't really have anything. When I say that, I don't mean that like, you know, like a hyperbole or anything. Like we literally came here with one duffel bag for the three of us, excuse me. And from there, we're able to kind of, you know, climb up, if you will. You know, we started there, were homeless for like a month or so. I was on food stamps for like a year or a year and a half or so. And then, you know, to me, I identify with that because then, you know, in the next like 10, 12 years, I was able to work at companies like Facebook, Twitter, Andreessen Horowitz, Asana, which are some of the most wealthy companies in the world. Mm-hmm. And I realized that when you're going from like survival mode and you're in survival mode, you don't really think about what you want. You think about how you survive. And so you are an afterthought in your own life. And so that's why Catalyst Creation, you know, I started it and I really want to help people understand that about themselves, that they are actually able to, regardless of where they came from, center themselves in their reality, in their career, in their life, because that's what really matters.
Amazing. That's really great. This is an Afro-Latinx podcast. So I want to dive into your Afro-Latinidad, course, but I have some questions from what you just said that I'll circle back to, but I would love to get a little bit on your journey of your Blackness. And how you celebrate it and how you discovered it.
Yeah, I love that. And I think it's kind of tied to like that journey that I mentioned, you know? And so being Afro-Latina, and first of all, I have to, you know, for those of you who are not looking at me, I am a very light-skinned Afro-Latina. I'm biracial. So my dad is Black. My mom is white. They're both Colombian. And I grew up in a primarily white area of Colombia. It's Bogota. Mm-hmm. Everybody's like light skin, it's the mountains, you know, everybody's mostly white. And during a time when there was not a lot of Black people. So I always knew that I was Black, but in Colombia, that's not really the driving factor like it is here in the US. In the US, it's kind of like what you lead with. It's very race focused, whereas in Colombia, it's more like socioeconomic. And I was privileged enough to be from a very high socioeconomic class. So although I knew I was Black, it never was a thing that stopped me because of my socioeconomic privilege in Colombia. And then I came here and then it was almost, you know, I was aware of it all of the time and not in the best way, right? In my mom and my family in general, they're very anti-Black. And so, you know, I had to kind of grapple with that. I was like 10 and people were like, oh, being Black is bad. You're Colombian. But I'm like, okay. And my sister was like, no, but we're Black. And so it was just like a whole thing. Mm-hmm. And you know, kind of like discovering the beauty of my Blackness was like a beautiful, or has been a beautiful journey. And I understand how privileged I am and even having the privilege to discover it and really own it. And so, you know, I think in high school and college, I really started understanding like, hey, like you can be both. You can be Black and you can be Colombian. It's not interchangeable. They're two very different things. And I was really able to embrace it and understand like, hey, like this is something that my ancestors, you know, like they passed down to me, right? They passed down to me. I get to really be proud of it. I get to create something beautiful out of it and really create this pride that I didn't grow up with, but I can assure that the community I'm surrounded by and then my future kids or my future family like is very proud. And I'm, you know, I'm kind of really grateful to be leading that charge because there's a lot of anti-Blackness that still exists.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of unlearning and relearning. And thankfully I've been able to have that, that experience very early on.
Yeah. It's something I love what you're saying about like how it is in Colombia compared to here. Cause it's actually something us as Dominicans, we've been discovering more and more and more the differences between us as Dominican Americans in terms of Blackness and race and like the people we speak to from Dominican Republic. And there's a lot more variation from the people we're speaking to in Dominican Republic about Blackness. Where here it's just like, it's such an interesting thing. I didn't think it would be so different. And it is very, very much different. Not for everyone, but for the most part, it's just been a really interesting process and discovery. And it's kind of sometimes a little hard to deal with and frustrating. We want to be like on the same wavelength, but it's just like, it feels a little impossible, but.
Yeah. Well, it's crazy because, you know, it does feel impossible. And I think that that is kind of the hard thing about being Afro Latinx is that duality that exists of like, well, are you Black or you're not? And it's like, yes, but it means so many different things depending on where you are, who you hang out with, and so, yeah. Or who you're around. And so I know that in Colombia, like my family says this as a nice thing. They're like, well, you're not Black. And I'm like, you're not really Black. And I'm like, they're like, you're Morenita. And I'm like, okay, all right, let's talk about that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's kind of like like almost like a compliment. Like that's a compliment, but I'm like, no, that's not a compliment because you're literally saying that like because I'm lighter, I'm better. And it's like, that's not, you know, there's different privileges that are afforded, but that doesn't mean that I'm, you know, like being light skin or anything like that is better at all. But I think that's the mentality that exists in Latin America. Whereas here, no matter how light skin you are, if you're like one drop, like you're Black.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
And
yeah.
So it's a very interesting, and then there's different privileges here with being light skin and then in Bogota as well. So, you know, it's a duality for me, at least, you know, because in Colombia, in Bogota specifically, I'm considered dark because I'm not white. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And in the States I'm considered light, and especially the Black community. And so it's like the different messages that sends and how you have to integrate that in yourself is really, really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. How was that experience from the quote unquote Black community? Because yes, we're Black, but I'm saying like, did you get any pushback of like people saying, oh, you can choose to kind of dip in and dip out? Or it's funny because in Colombia, yeah, you are considered dark skinned, but in other countries or here, they're like, what? You're dark skinned? What are you talking about? So how was that pushback for you?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting. And honestly, it came, it was really interesting because it came at a time, I think, where I was really discovering myself from all different angles. And I think, especially I'll speak to this as a woman, I think it has to do a lot with beauty. And in Colombia, so I grew up not thinking I was beautiful at all because, you know, I wasn't light enough. I wasn't white enough. My hair wasn't straight enough. My hair, you know, I just wasn't it, you know, and it being like white. And
yeah,
you know, everybody, I think a lot, not everybody, that's not fair to say, but a lot of people in Latin America, especially growing up like in the 90s or 2000s, like we wanted to be the J-Lo's, Shakira's, you know, that's what was really on, like what a Latina looked like. And I never looked like that. So And in Colombia, a lot of people do, or a lot of people look even whiter than that. So, you know, it was just kind of like really interesting growing up. And I was like, I didn't pay attention to my appearance. I didn't think, you know, everybody was checking for me. Like I, you know, I was just like, not even in that. And then it was actually at work when a Black woman pointed out how gorgeous I was. And I quote, like literally pulled me into a meeting. She was my manager and was like, well, you're gorgeous and your life is perfect. And, you know, everybody hates you. And I was like, excuse me?
What?
And I say that because the people involved were like, it was like two Black women, one, darker skinned, like both of them darker skinned than me, but one really, really dark skin. And that was the first time I realized colorism actually played into a lot of things. And I didn't even know because I was not treated as, you know, light skin. And now, since then, this happened in 2016, now I'm very aware of my privilege. I talk about it a lot. And I'm like, hey, I understand that in the Black community, I do have privilege and I have gotten pushback because I am so light. But the thing is, like, I'm using my privilege for good. I get invited to things. Mm-hmm. I get to do things. I'm invited to the table because of the way I look. But I'm always there being like, okay, is there room for more? Can we actually get mm-hmm. somebody who represents a different perspective of the Black experience? Because I ain't it. Like, I'm not it, you know? Yeah. I have a very nuanced experience, but I'm not the only one that can speak for the whole community. So I think privilege is not a bad thing. And people, I think, associate privilege being a bad word, like they're like, yeah, oh, bad. But it's like, no, once you realize you have privilege, then you can use that to create pathways for those who don't have the same amount of privilege. And that's what I try to use, specifically like my Afro Latinidad, both in the Latinx community and the Black community, to advance everybody's stories and everybody's narratives, because I think everybody matters, quite frankly, and more people need to be represented who do not look like me.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think really, it's great that
really
you
awesome.
Yeah.
It actually reminds me, this is the circle back that I kind of wanted to do of what you were saying when you were introducing yourself, which is like this difference between like the mentality of how to survive in scarcity and realizing that like you can actually have abundance and have happiness, even sort of in that mindset, I think is what I was getting from what you were saying before. And I'm just curious on like how that journey for you and how you utilize that journey to help the brown and Black people in your company mm-hmm. to get them to that place of like, no, there is an abundance of stuff, you know, happiness. Cause like, and I'm going to blow up my own spot, but like I'm on food stamps right now. Like I'm unemployed. I have food stamps. I collect unemployment. I'm a freelance artist. So it's been hard to get work. And I don't think I have a scarcity mindset or anything like that, but I'm just curious for the listeners out there who may want to seek that and just don't know where to start because it's so hard mm-hmm. to kind of lift yourself up out of that mindset.
Yeah. And first of all, thank you for sharing. That's so tough because I think it plays into the stereotypes that people already have of like, oh, being, you know, Black or brown and unemployed mm-hmm. and on food, like it plays into so many stereotypes. And I think the thing that people miss about survival and scarcity, and I, again, I'm speaking from a very privileged position because I have not, you know, like the experience that I have with it's very limited. People think it's like, okay, like it's like a handout, when in reality, like people, when you're in that situation, like quite literally, that's the only thing sometimes that's helping support you.
Mm-hmm.
And that mindset of, I need to do the most that I can with the least. You take that into your whole life. And that's kind of how I was actually talking to a friend right now. I've lived from that mentality for a long time. And I think I'm just now, 22 years later, getting out of it. Meaning that I was like talking to her and I was like, I've always been looked at the privileged one in my family because I speak English, because, you know, I ended up working for all of these companies because I was really smart from a young age. Like there's just a lot of things, you know, I was born in the States and then I moved back to Colombia and came back. So I had like citizenship. So I've been looked at as like the privileged person. And so I grew up thinking, okay, well, even though I'm going through food stamps, or, you know, I had food stamps, and even though we were homeless, and even though like my dad left and all of this stuff, like, it's fine. It's okay. Like, you are privileged. You are okay. And I kept going and being like, you know, everything that I get is like great because it's not where I was before. Mm-hmm. And so when a lot of Black and Brown people who have had similar experiences go through that, it's almost like you're always seeking something else from somebody else externally, not knowing that you can actually create what you want internally. And that's a shift that you have to make. And it takes a lot of work because you have to be able to face yourself, face your traumas, and be like, hey, this happened. And even though this happened, and because this happened, I am so much stronger for it, and I can continue creating more experiences that I want. And that piece is so difficult because then you're not depending externally from validation or for mm-hmm. anything. You're now, you know, shifting internally and being like, yes, I am here in this particular position, but I know that I will be able to get over there, even though I don't have the privileges that a lot of people at that level do have. And so, you know, it's a lot of work. I'm not going to lie. The work is real.
Yeah.
I've been through that now, actually. I'm in a little bit of debt, and I haven't talked about that, but starting my business, I got into a little bit of debt, and it feels like I'm in the same place I was 22 years ago, even though I'm not. But because your brain actually processes trauma the same way. So like if you're in any similar situation, like The Body Keeps the Score is a really good book that people can read if they're in this situation, but and explains like the science behind how trauma works in your body. Even though it's 22 years later and I'm not in the same situation, I'm still reverting back to those survival tactics and, you know, that I developed when I was 9 because my brain thinks I'm going through the same thing.
Yeah.
So it's like, how do you break out of that? How do you understand what's happening, be able to look at it, and also balance the comfort versus newness? Because you can't just go from comfort and, you know, like being comfortable with something to just jumping and being like, okay, like now I'm this person because
yeah,
that's a journey. It's not, you know, it's just not overnight.
Yeah.
I love that. So much to unpack. I love what your business is about, Catalyst Creations. I want to talk more about your experience in corporate America and how Catalyst Creations came out of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And thank you all for giving me this. This is actually really healing. I've been going through it because I'm moving in 2 weeks, like I mentioned, and it's bringing up all of this stuff, and just talking about this is really therapeutic. So thank you so much. People need to own their story in order for them to kind of heal from it. And kind of getting to the question that you just asked, I say that because for a long time I thought my story was, you know, kind of normal in a sense. It's not. There's a lot of workplace trauma there. It's normal, but there's a lot of workplace trauma is what I mean. Like, it's not normal from the sense of like this trauma shouldn't have happened, but and I'm saying trauma a lot because I'm owning it. I'm owning the fact that as Black and Brown people, we have been traumatized and people don't talk about that. People are like, oh yeah, that was hard, but whatever. But it's like, it's actually much deeper than just the thing that happened, especially if you haven't processed a lot of what your upbringing was or like the things that you face daily, even now. Right. And so basically my journey into corporate America, I ended up going to school in, I got a full ride scholarship to Nebraska. So I moved from Columbia, Houston to Nebraska. Didn't know anyone. It was less than diverse. if you can't run drifts, I think it was like 90%, 95%, white, majority white. And so, you know, being in that space, it actually was great training ground for corporate America because I was able to realize like, oh, if I'm coming in like a person that just moved here, from Columbia, I grew up in a very Colombian household in Houston, even though I was there for 8 years, that's not going to cut it. Right. And so it was like my first foray into code switching. And that's what really allowed me, I think, to get jobs at Johnson & Johnson, at Facebook, at Twitter, Andreessen Horowitz, Asana, because I was able to turn it on, to, at least to get in the door, right? But then what happened is that I was able to turn it off enough to get in the door. But once you get in the door, you have to keep playing. You have to keep kind of playing that persona that you come in with. And I didn't realize. I'm like, oh no, they hired me. They knew who I was. Like I was, yeah, I was kind of like playing it down a little bit, but they knew, you know, I was outspoken. I was going to call them out. And the reality is, you know, very quickly it evolved from model minority to aggressive minority, you know, aggressive Black woman, I will say. And, it was just kind of like a consistent story. So for example, at one of my companies, like I had a meeting with like all of my white peers basically, and they talked about my hair and they were like, it's not professional. We need it to be professional like it was on day one. And it was one of my first jobs and I didn't know that I could say anything. I was like, well, if I say something and I lose my job, what happens?
Yeah. Right?
I can't afford that. I had another instance where like a manager outright was like, is the reason you're aggressive is because you're Colombian. And I was like, excuse me.
Oh my God.
And I broke down and I cried to her and I was like, what, you know, what's going on? And then at another job, like, you know, it was, basically I wasn't friendly enough and I wasn't, you know, people didn't feel like I was taking feedback or people didn't feel like I was being nice in the way that I was just responding. And they were like, I'll give you like 2 weeks and we'll go around and ask everybody how they feel about you to see if we want to keep you on. So like things like that, where I'm like, quite literally, I was put in a place where I was not gonna be okay. I was not gonna, you know, I was not set up for success. And that's the case for a lot of Black and Brown folks, but especially.
Oh my God. I'm like, fuck these people right now. I'm like, fuck these motherfuckers.
But yeah, so, but that's what I say about, you know, owning your story and owning your trauma, because I'm able to talk about this now. Cause before I felt a lot of shame, I was like, mm-hmm. It's my fault. I should have smiled more. I should have been friendlier. I should have been, you know, this and that. And all underneath all of this thinly veiled is like being a Black woman. And because I'm like, and the question becomes is like, had I been Latina, like, you know, blonde hair, blue eyed Latina, would that have been the same consequence? And I don't think that's true.
Yeah.
I don't think that would have been the same, received the same way or, you know, acted on the same way. And, you know, that's when it starts to be like, okay, like this is actually like owning my story and owning what could have been the reason, because we'll never actually know the reason why all of these things happen. And that's like, I think the hardest thing about being Black is like, you don't know if it is because of it or if it's not. Like Afro-Latino, Afro-Latinx or not, like your skin color always comes into play.
Yeah.
And I think that's what a lot of people don't get about Blackness. It's like, you just never know if that is a factor or not.
I love how candid you are about being fired. Let's start with that.
Oh yeah. I have fired three times.
Yeah. I have worked in corporate America and I have stories for days. What advice do you have to those who are in that position right now where they, you know, they have to be at that job? They need to pay some bills. They are the only Latina there. They are the only Afro-Latina there or the only person of color. And they are feeling those microaggressions because they are real. And also, at the same time, my second question, think about this too, is for those people that did get laid off or did get fired, and they know that it was because of microaggressions or other situations, you know,
racism.
Yeah, which is real, but they hide it under other things. They'll be like, oh, we got to make some cuts. But anyway, so like, let's say those people that are in that, because we are raised to love our jobs and we are raised, a lot of us, that you are your job, you are your position. Mm-hmm. And it's a luxury. It's a privilege to be able to pursue your passion. I think not many people can actually fully do that because they have kids, they have responsibilities. And, you know, what advice do you have to those that are in that situation where they're in a job that they freaking hate? Okay. Mm-hmm. They fucking hate going to work every morning, but they have to go. And And then those that have gotten an opportunity because of COVID to be laid off that are wanting to start fresh and think about their passions?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's a really great question. And it goes back to what we were talking about with Rocio about survival versus, you know, thriving. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of people who are at jobs that they hate are in survival mode. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's like I you know, I get a paycheck, it's steady. You know, I don't have to be on food stamps. I don't have to be on unemployment. And it's almost kind of like a shame, again, a shame factor associated with the worst that could happen, right? And it's about getting from, especially for those people who are in jobs that they hate, is getting from the mentality of you have to be there, that they are from, you have to be there to, they are paying you to be there and somebody else will pay you also to be there. Mm-hmm. And that's the first step, realizing that you don't have to, that they're paying you. And then if you leave, they'll be in big trouble too. And how much value you actually add to an organization, even if you're like entry level, even if you're like, you feel like you're not, you are a huge value add, right? And getting to that mentality and really creating, like literally sitting there. And if this is you and you hate your job and you're like, oh my God, I don't know what to do. Literally make a list of all of the things that you've done. And I'm not talking about like, you know, the little things. I'm talking about the big things. Like what would happen? What would have happened if you weren't there? And so really thinking about it from that perspective to help build that self-confidence. Because once you're able to build that self-confidence and see what you've been able to do in your career, then you can start being like, okay, I value, I am valuable. Where do I want to, what type of organization do I want to move to that would see that? Mm-hmm. And then you start creating a list of organizations you want to check out, right? And start going at it from a place of, I have a job, I don't like it, but I have a job, I'm getting paid. And using the spare time that I have to look for a job or a company that would be a better fit and start making small connections, whether that's like with a person you went to college or a friend of a friend, you know, and start networking, because that's usually how these conversations to like move get started, right? Mm-hmm. So just being, making small moves, because again, like I would not recommend like, I hate this job, I'm gonna quit, because that's gonna put you right back into survival mode.
Yeah.
You're gonna be like, I need to get a job tomorrow, and that's not gonna be a great process, right? Mm-hmm. I had to do it because I was fired. I was like, okay. But I would not, that's not the easiest way to do that. Mm-hmm. And for the people who have experienced microaggressions at work and have gotten laid off, you know, take this as an opportunity to, if you can, right, rest, take that severance and like make it work for you, right? Yeah. Take a month off. I know that sounds like a lot for most people, but if it's not a month, maybe 2 weeks. And just think about what you want to do. And again, it's all about baby steps. It's all about laying out and really asking yourself questions and being like, okay, what do I want to do now? And making a list of the roles that you might want to do. And then from there, creating your own job description. Maybe it's like you looked at 5 jobs and you're like, you know, I would like to do this from this one, that one from this one, this one from that one, and creating your own job description. And then once you have that, using that as a rubric to go out and look for jobs and have conversations with people at companies that you think that you'd be a good fit at and be like, hey, these are the things that I would really like to do. Do you have maybe a role for that? Or do you have an opportunity to maybe create a role like that? Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that privilege, because sometimes we don't have the network to do that, again, start building that network, start finding people who have similar stories to you, who are from the same hometown or from the same country or, you know, from the same like university, ask all your friends for help, like start really building that network if you don't have it, because that's going to be the number one thing to really mm-hmm. help you get to the job that you really want and feel comfortable in.
I love that. Create your own job description. Yeah, I love that. Great. That's very empowering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the thing is like anyone can do that, but we don't think that we can. But honestly, you know how job descriptions are created? Somebody, like the company hires a recruiter. The recruiter is like tasked with finding someone for a job. And they literally sit down and create a job description in like 30 minutes, an hour.
Yeah.
And then maybe it's reviewed by D&I. Maybe it's reviewed by HR. But most of the time it's not. Maybe you use like little templates online to make sure it's like as inclusive as possible. But like somebody made that up. Why can't that somebody be you?
For sure.
Yeah. What advice do you have to managers or companies that don't have diversity and inclusion just yet? Now it's a trend right now, diversity and inclusion, but it's real. We actually need that. But a lot of companies are just starting to start having that in their companies. What advice do you have to managers or companies?
Yeah. So I think for managers, it's a little bit of a different ballgame because you have to be a little bit more upfront. You have power, right? And if you're a manager, it depends. If you're a manager of color versus you're a manager, you're like a white manager. If you're a white manager, it's all about educating yourself to understand what your like direct reports are going through or could go through and putting yourself in awkward situations, right? So having awkward conversations and being like, hey, you know, if you're like, for example, if you're talking to the only black woman on your team or the only Latinx person on your team or the only Asian person on your team, it's like, hey, I noticed that, you know, you are the only one who looks like you on my team. Like, how does that feel? How can I help support? That's a really awkward conversation for like a white person to have because they've never had to do that. But like, that would be a really big show of support, right? To just, you know, with the direct reports, and then level that up to like management when you have management meetings and being like, hey, how are we supporting our people of color? How are we actually making sure that they're being included? And as a white manager, I think that's much easier, right? If you're a manager of color, obviously, you know what people are going through, right? Because you've probably gone through it yourself. And it's all about like creating and identifying allies and letting your direct reports know, hey, these are the people I've at my level been able to work with, been able to like develop relationships with. So you can have allies as well, right? And allies meaning like, you know, from any background. But I think as a manager of color, it's like creating pathways and furthering pathways by creating more allies and kind of being responsible for like the education of the people at that level so that real change can be made.
Something you said that I thought was really interesting was, sorry, going back, just hearing your stories about going to Nebraska and kind of discovering like this code switching situation. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious if you still do that, if you encourage it, or if it's something that like you actually try to get away from and you think we should like dismantle in any way. I'm just curious in your opinion about it.
Yeah, that's a really, really powerful question. I think code switching is a very personal thing. I have done it for so long that I kind of do it like almost without thinking. Mm-hmm. And I've been catching myself lately and been like, no, like, do that. Why are you code switching? Especially since I'm speaking on a lot more podcasts now and, you know, being a lot more public. Now I'm like, why are you code switching? And really calling myself out. And I think I have the freedom to do that. And I have made that choice for myself. I think when working with organizations and places that are maybe not as open, it's really asking yourself, how much am I willing to sacrifice of myself to go into a company like this, to have this level of success, to assimilate a little bit into the culture because the culture doesn't look like me, right? Mm-hmm. And asking yourself, how much of yourself do you actually want to give up? And so I think when you ask yourself that question, if you're okay with giving up a part of yourself in order to a part of your vernacular and how you express yourself in order to be associated with a particular company or get a particular raise or get a particular title, then, you know, do what you got to do, right? Mm-hmm. But it comes with being really real with yourself and being like, is this something I'm willing to do for the next 3 to 5 years?
Yeah.
Right. Or at least the first 6 months while I get into the door, and then I can, you know, start, you know, kind of loosening up a bit. And if the answer is no, then don't go to a company like that. Then go to a company that is, you know, very inclusive and won't care about that stuff. But to believe that every company right now is at the point where everybody can just come in without any type of code switching, I don't think it's true. Like, especially like older institutions, Finance institutions, for example, like, you know, that's going to be a little bit of a different game than, for example, like a startup in tech that's very focused on, you know, D&I and inclusion, and it's very millennial focused. And so, you know, it's just kind of knowing your audience and being like, am I willing to perform?
Yeah.
Yes or no?
Yeah.
It's so interesting. That's a great question, Rocio.
Yeah.
It's hard not to code switch sometimes when you're in the office. You catch yourself, because I don't really talk like this all the time, but at work, sometimes you'll catch me speaking. And I'm like, why am I talking like this? You know what I mean? It's like automatic. You just, sometimes it's ingrained in you because, like you said, you've been doing it for so, so long.
I will say that I think this is the first generation where, like, the Gen Z generation, where I feel like that might just come to an end once millennials are, you know, in the C-suite, Gen Z is like up the ranks. I think like the end of code switching is near.
There
are organizations that are doing it.
Yeah.
Are doing a great job of just allowing people to come as they are. But we're still not fully there yet. And it's like you figuring out for yourself what you want.
Yeah. I think the reason why I've code switched before is I'm an artist, and I've been to many a room where it's like, you know, the administration or like the production team and the only person of color. And sometimes I code switch just because I'm like, oh shit, I represent all of the Black people. It took such a long time for me to be like, no, I don't represent all the Black people. I just represent me. But, you know, it took years for me to get that, because that was how they were looking at me. Like, if I fucked up, I fucked up for the rest of the Black people they hired. Mm-hmm. And that's fucked up. It should be just me, you know. I shouldn't be like this catalyst or this thing to represent everybody, because white people don't do that to other white people. So I was just interested in what you thought about that, because I'm guilty too, and I still struggle with it, and I'm really trying to just let that go.
And even the pressure of representing yourself, what does that mean? Because some people think they code switch because they are representing themselves, and they put so much, us as people of color, we put a lot of pressure on ourselves sometimes to be, you know, or I need to make sure that I prove to these white people that I am this and educated. I'm an educated Black person. So it's like, even that, some people put that pressure on themselves to code switch just for them, their own selves. So it's deep.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's why I think it's really important to ask yourself before you start a job, like, what, you know, am I willing to play this part? Like you said, you're an artist. You know, I recently was in a commercial. Hey. And I realized, I was like, yeah, I think going to corporate America is kind of like playing a part. And get full control as the talent to be like, yo, do I want to play this part? If the answer is no, the answer is no. And like, that's why I ended up starting my company, because I realized, I was like, yo, I'm going to play this part. The part that they have cast me in is the... is like the surprise villain. And I'm tired of being the surprise villain. I'm a nice person. I can, you know, create impact. But every single job that I've had, I go in and everybody's so excited. And turns out I'm the bad guy.
That is hilarious.
It's like a dinner. I'm playing that part. And I'm like, I have tried different costumes. I have tried different lines. Like, it's just not working. And so I was just like, I got tired of it. I was like, that's not the part I want to play. And I'm not. And I'm just like, no, I want to be the hero for once, like the true hero.
I kind of like being the surprise villain, actually. Like sometimes because I've been in corporate America for a long time, so I can relate to everything you're saying. And I love how people make assumptions of who they think you are. And it's just like, wait, you don't know me, boo. Like, no, I'm multifaceted. Do you even care? Do you even care? You don't.
I had an experience where I was like, I'm not even gonna say anything, because like at this point, like you think you know so much about me that I cannot. So we were in a car and we were like driving up, because we like worked far away from where I lived. And so I was with two of my coworkers, and one of these, my coworkers, she's like, this woman, she was like, I think the same age as me, you know? And we were talking and she's like, well, you know, God, that you don't understand, because, you know, you're so free. You know, I have a lot of pressure. I have a lot of pressure on me because, you know, I have, you know, I have to look out for my parents. I have to, you know, I have to be, you know, this person. And you know, I just have a lot of, you don't get it. And I was like, yeah, I don't at all. Like, I don't at all. You know, I don't get it, because the majority of my family is living in a third world country. I don't get it. But like, yeah, sure. Tell me about that.
Yeah.
I had a woman like come in, and she was telling me about her wedding, and she was like, you will not believe how much drama there is because my parents are divorced, and like, you know, my dad won't talk to my mom, blah, blah, blah. You won't believe. And I was like, no. Yeah. I was like, oh wow. That's so hard. And not downplaying that it's hard, but I'm like, my dad left when I was 9 and like did all of this stuff. And like, I'm like, I could either in those moments, I could either go and really explain myself and be like, oh, I get what you're talking about and more, or I can just be like, you know, you're committed to misunderstanding how my reality and how I got there, because you didn't even think that in these situations, like I would even understand, you know?
Yeah.
And I say that because those are, it's a different form of microaggression, because I think as, people see Black and brown people who have made it as like these almost like, they're like, oh, well, you're one of the good ones. You have all of, you know, you're talented, you're educated. Like you have gone through like, you know, nothing, like you're here. Like, it's kind of like, they don't understand that like the actual amount of work that it took to get there compared to what maybe they had to go through. Again, that word of privilege, they don't understand their own privilege. And it's, you know, that's a really hard thing to deal with in corporate America as well.
I love all that. I love Catalyst Creations and what you have created, because it would have been so easy for you to go get another job, right? Mm-hmm. And just, okay, I'm just going to go and get another job and deal with the same situations. But no, you went and created something that is fulfilling. So my question is, now you said that the younger generations, it might change the whole code switching. So what advice do you have to the youth who, for example, I have a cousin who was applying to be an intern to a job, right? And she showed me her cover letter, and it was all right. It was pretty basic though. It was like, you know, in the sense of, I wanted her to be okay to show more of her personality and where she came from, because I knew as a Dominican, her experience and her journey of how she got into style is going to make her stand out. And so I wanted her to embrace that and know when you apply to these jobs, you're going to stand out regardless. And it's okay to stand out. And so what advice do you have to our youth who are coming into the workforce and want to get into tech and want to get in there, but they look different? How can we help them embrace who they are more in corporate America?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And I think, honestly, it's all about, you know, again, working on your confidence before you get into the door, and realizing that being different is a strength and is what's going to actually allow you to make tangible change in a room. But I think that when you're young, you want to be just like everybody else. And if everybody else doesn't look like you, then you're like, I'm going to become that for as much as I can. I can't change my skin color. I can't change my hair, but I can, you know, well, yes, some of us can. Actually, most of us can and have, you know, straightening your hair, that part was real. But like, you know, it's about, you know, just going in and really owning that. And I think it starts with finding people that are out there that have done the same thing, have been the first, and talking to them about the experience. And that's why I think it's the power of, and I think social media has made it's so much easier to just connect with someone who's similar to you, because in talking to somebody who looks like you and talking to somebody who's had your same experience, then you're going to be a little bit more comfortable being like, oh yeah, there's not that many of people who look like me, but there are people that have come before me. And so I'm able to really stand out. But I think before, if you can't make that connection and everybody that you know is not in that field or in that specific role, then it's going to be really hard for you to just show up and not try to be somebody else. Because I think people need to be able to see before they can be, you know, people need to, I think there's a quote, there's like, be who you, or see who you want to be or something like that. I'm butchering the quote, but you know, you have to be able to see yourself before you can actually be yourself, especially in spaces where you're going to be one of the only.
That's why I think mentorship is so important, especially for us. We don't have enough mentors to help us, guide us to see. We are usually the first ones in those spaces. And so I think even when I try to remind myself as well, when I'm in those spaces to encourage and motivate someone younger than me, because I didn't have that. My mentors were white. I mean, they were awesome, but they didn't look like me.
But I do think that there's also a good, so mentorship is really interesting, because I think that mentorship from any place is good, especially from people who don't look like you, because they see the they see all the possibilities versus the obstacles. So I think that, like, for your mentors, being white is great because they're like, look, you could do this, that, and the other. They don't have to play by the same rules, but they can show you how to play the game, right? Mm-hmm. And then when your mentors who do look like you can show you how to kind of tailor it so that you are coming in and playing the game, and like being aware of like what your player, what your piece actually is able to do, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's important to have both. And I also think it's important to not put mentors on a pedestal. Cause I think that when I hear the word mentorship, I always think of like someone older than me that is like, got it figured out. It's like, no one has it figured out. So let's,
yeah.
You know, when talking about mentors, whether they're white or not, like, they're people. They're people first. And I think is leading with, hey, what do you find interesting about the person and not just what they've done? Because if you just follow, if you create mentorship based off what people have done, it's really going to be superficial. And what you want out of a mentor is someone who's really invested in you and like you can actually click on a personal level, even if they're not the same race as you. Like, go that extra mile to find something that you both are interested in, because that'll create a stronger bond.
That's a really good point. I have another question that has nothing to do with what we're just talking about, but it's bringing it back to the beginning about, we have to talk about this. You're from Colombia. I'm from Dominican Republic and stuff. And we need to talk about a little bit about body image. Did you have any pressure? You know how Colombia and DR people be going over there to get their bodies done. And we know at a young age, a lot of women in Dominican Republic and Colombia have pressure to augment their body or change it so that it looks what society views as beautiful. How did you go through body image issues and how did you resolve it? Because I love the commercial that you did. What I love about it is you're just like embracing everything, you know, like, and they have you in this cute little blue dress and everything. And you're like, yes, I'm here. What? So very confident, as you should be. But how was that journey of coming through that with the pressures that sometimes we have in our culture to look a certain way?
Oh my God, I love this question. I don't think I've ever addressed this like publicly, but I'm glad that I have the opportunity to, or no, I think I've addressed it once. I think publicly I was like trying to get picked for like a bikini ad or something. And I was like, oh, pick me. I have body image issues. But so it's funny because so by society, so like by society standards, I'm, you know, depending on what society you're talking about, but American society standards, I'm great, right? I'm a size, I think, 0 or 2,
mm-hmm.
You know, petite frame, 5 foot, very cute, you know, very, cute. Very like petite. It's nice. People want to put me in their pocket. Mm-hmm. that's something I've heard all the time. But the reality is growing up, you know, especially being Black, being Latin, being Afro-Latina, like, what you wanted to be was curvaceous. What you wanted to be was, you know, have 90, 60, 90. Like, you
wait,
know,
what?
I remember,
say that
I
again.
Being in Colombia, like growing up and being like, if you don't have these measurements, you're not beautiful. Like, I remember as a child, and still to this day, it kind of haunts me. Like, my waist is not naturally small because I'm, you know, I'm very slim, but my waist is not naturally small. But I remember like my mom's friends were like, you know, you have to start working on your waist. You have to use waist trainers. You have to, cause you have to have a small waist. And like everybody in Colombia, like, you know, gets, get stuff done. And you know, just like, it looks like super curvaceous, but it's not even real. And so it's, you know, it's something that I really struggled with when I was growing up. And I was like, maybe one day, one day that will happen to me. And my sister is actually, growing up, she was very voluptuous, and I was not. And that also played into the, you know, the stereotype of like, you know, you're not black enough, you're not Latina enough because you're not curvaceous. You don't have curves. Like, you know, you need to have these in order to feel like a woman. And, especially as like black and Latinx women, like, I think that's the trope that we get told a lot. And so it's been quite a journey of like accepting my body type and accepting that I'm beautiful, even though I'm smaller. You know, accepting that that's okay. And, you know, I have maybe thought about plastic surgery and I'm like, no, I like being myself. You know, I like having, you know, my body, and it's not perfect by any means, but it served me really well. And, you know, in that commercial, I felt so crazy because Sofia Vergara was like in a commercial similar to that. You know, in the 1990s, and Sofia Vergara, like, you see her, I look nothing like her. I'm like, we're representing the same brand. Like, that's insane.
That's awesome.
And yeah, no, but that's, I was like so excited and so confident because I'm like, wow, people are going to see me and people are going to be, you know, be able to relate to that. Mm-hmm. And I realize that even when I share that, I'm coming from a very privileged situation and position, because a lot of women have the opposite problem where they're, you know, more voluptuous and, you know, they have, you know, they have a lot to work with, and that's great. Like, I'm like, that's awesome. But I think this, so I'm coming from the, you know, being too small. Other people do struggle with feeling too big or whatever, but, and you know, my sister, she's actually overweight. And so, and she's been kind of in that weight loss journey. So I've kind of been exposed to all of these things of like trying to be perfect. And the reality is there's no perfection. It's like, yeah, your body is your body. And as long as you feel healthy, as long as you feel good, that's really all that matters. But it is a journey to get there.
Yeah, for sure. And it's like, it's just like, I love that question, Mercedes, too, especially like, as a Dominican, one of the experiences that I had, because we have this like mind fuckery with food. It's like, eat all your food. But then it's like, oh, pero si tu comes así, tu, you know, you're going to get fat. You know what I mean? But it's like, wait, you told me to eat all my food. But when I eat all my food, you tell me I'm going to get fat. And it's like all this fucked up messaging. It's usually from men in the family who's like, oh, tu eres gordita, blah, blah, blah. But then like the women are like, oh, muy flaca, coño. You know, it's just like so confusing.
It's like, what do you want? Yeah. What is it at the end of the day? It's fine. Whatever, yeah, is fine.
Like, I'm healthy.
Yeah, but
I'm
when you're like 12, healthy. When you're like 10 or 12, you don't know that. Yeah. You know what I mean? Because this is messaging I got when I was young.
Yeah.
I mean, I still get, you know, the messages. I don't know about you. Thanksgiving dinners, I'm still getting messages.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. No, me too.
Mira, tú estás gorda.
Yeah.
Mira. Hey.
Well, like, I think.
So no más. No más comida. Oh.
Yeah, it's crazy. And like, that's the thing. Like, it's just so, I think people, I read this thing and it's like, you should not comment about people's appearance like at all.
Like at all.
Because
just don't do it.
Just don't do it. Compliments.
Exactly.
Compliment their, yeah, eyes.
Not anything else. And also I do, and I will say this, and I haven't really talked about this publicly, but there are areas that I am a proponent of like help if you need it, if you feel like you need it. So I actually get crow's feet really bad. You can't see them now, but I do get crow's feet very badly. And I went to Colombia and I got Botox for the first time.
What? How was that?
I actually did a lot for my confidence because I wasn't worried. I'm on camera a lot. So I wasn't worried about, you know, do I look this? Do I look tired? Do I look, you know, that was a decision that I made and I still do it, right? I do it like once a year and I'm just like, okay, like kind of like preventative. And that's okay. I feel good about that. Yeah. So if somebody really is like, yo, I need to go to Colombia, to the DR to do some work, go for it. Like, I'm not here to judge. But
yeah, totally.
At the end of the day, I think it's, where is it coming from? Is it coming from a place of like, you know, confidence and being like, this is going to help me be my most confident self? Or is it coming from a place of lack, right? Mm-hmm. Of like, if I don't do this, I won't get this. And so you know, I think it's important to see kind of where it's coming from.
Mm, totally. Oh, I'm all about that Botox girl. I'm all about that.
I'm like, I'm sorry, I have a white side. like black don't crack, but I'm half white. So like, let me not let it show all the time.
Oh my God, I love that. So we're going to close out. We're going to start closing out. I feel like I could talk to you forever. I'm like, let's close out before we're here for another hour. we're kind of, this is a season two and we're kind of like messing. This is probably like what all podcasters would say not to do, but we're doing it anyway because we're rebellious, but we're kind of experimenting and like changing our final questions a bit. But these are our final questions. And the first one is, what are your three favorite things about Colombian culture or Afro-Colombian culture?
Mm-hmm. So I think for me, those are two different questions. I love the question, by the way. I think for me, those are two different answers because my Colombian culture is different than my Afro-Latinx mm-hmm. culture, just because of the families I grew up with. Again, a lot of anti-Blackness.
Yeah.
But my favorite thing about being Colombian is that we genuinely are some of the sweetest and most thoughtful people that I've ever met. And I've been to a lot of different places, and a Colombian will take their shirt off their back and give it to you. Will like invite you to anything. If they don't have anything to share, they'll still split that down the middle and be like, here, you can share it with me, in a way where I don't know, like Cubans are actually very similar to this, but it's just like this communal sense, the sense of community, the sense of like wanting to help, which I find beautiful. And I'm like, mm-hmm. wow, like that's really, really beautiful that we're so generous. Also, la salsa, of course. You know, I'm actually trying to learn how to dance salsa caleña because I think it's so cool. It's like fast salsa. It's like amazing. And that kind of goes into the Afro-Latinidad a little bit because obviously salsa has Afro and African roots. And but I think my favorite thing about being Afro-Latina is that I get to re-embrace and retell the story of my ancestors and not have it be a shame that, you know, they had some melanin in their skin, but instead kind of take that and make it magic and remind everybody in the Latinx community how beautiful and how magical it is to have melanin.
Mm-hmm. Love it.
Nice. I like that. So, Cata, how do you celebrate your full self?
Ooh. Y'all are hitting me with the questions. It's like a therapy session. How do I celebrate my full self? You know, I'm still experimenting with that. I'll be really real. I don't have all the answers. I think that's something that I'm still figuring out, especially right now, which I think is a darker time in my life, where it's like I'm processing a lot of my trauma and I have to figure out how to celebrate myself when I'm not feeling like myself, because mm-hmm. as you see, like on Instagram or like what you've seen, like I can be such a bright light, but I also can be a little ball of darkness. And I'm still trying to figure out how to celebrate that darkness with my light and kind of put them together. So I don't really have an answer for that, but I think, you know, I'm just figuring it out. So stuff like this helps, like being on podcasts, and like being able to tell my story or just like taking walks and being outside in the sun. But also maybe like sometimes just watching Netflix and just like, you know, eating your favorite food. Like, I think it really depends on what mood you are and being able to like really tap into what does your inner child need right now mm-hmm. and how much do you actually have to be a strict parent or like a more lenient parent. And that's I guess like the fun in figuring that out.
Yeah. I love your honesty. I had to teach myself a long time ago that it's okay to not be okay because mm-hmm. we're raised sometimes that In my childhood, if you tell them you're having a bad day, they automatically think, ay, mira, no, te va a volver loca, what's going on, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's okay.
No, está bien.
Yeah, I'm not that's okay not, today.
That doesn't help.
Right.
It does not help.
Yeah, and I love that you are talking about embracing our traumas. That's something that, you know, people, it's another buzzword going on right now, but it's actually an important journey to embrace our traumas and see everybody has them. I said there should be a dating site. What's your trauma? And then you talk about it from the gate, match each other up.
Yeah.
You know what exactly. I'm saying? No, and but, see if your traumas match.
I think it's also seeing like the different generational traumas that exist. Because what I've come to realize, like me as a 1.5 generation immigrant, meaning that I actually lived there and went through the experience of like being an immigrant, even though I wasn't because I had my U.S. citizenship, I still to this day have to do things mostly by myself. Like that is just a reality of my life. Like I don't have a village, like a family village here. I have friends, but friends also have limitations, right? Mm-hmm. And it's the reality of accepting like my journey will always look different than like my my second generation or like first generation. I don't remember what is it first or second generation, but basically their parents migrated and they were here and they were born here and they grew up in the States. Like that's a different level of that's a different journey and that's a different yeah. level of trauma. And it's a different type of trauma. And it's not that it's more or less, it's just very different. And like understanding and seeing that someone may be in a more privileged position, right? Resource wise or whatever, doesn't mean that they have it easier. It's just like they're dealing with something else. Mm-hmm. And being able to be empathetic to their struggle as well, even though it may seem from the outside that it's easier. And I think that's applicable to like all groups. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, whether you're Black, Latinx, white, Asian, like everybody has to deal with something. And it's having the empathy to be like, yes, some people have privilege and it's still hard. And yeah. it's still really difficult to be a human being on this earth right now. Mm-hmm. Like that's, you know, and if everybody realized that, then I think the world would be like all the world's problems would be solved because honestly, like you would be able to see everybody's going through it.
Yeah.
You know, and it is harder for some people than others. And that's unfortunate. But for those people who it is harder for, it's for those people who do have a little bit more privilege to be like, hey, like, I see you, and here's how I can help.
Well, thank you so much for doing this. This is so fun. Getting to know you even more and, like, chatting with you has just been so fun. And I love how you say, like, oh, this is very therapeutic and healing, because it basically almost every episode for us is like that as well. So it's just, like, fun to hear somebody else.
Yeah, for sure. Where can our listeners find you?
You can find me on Instagram at at Curious Gata. I have to change from English to Spanish, so sometimes that's hard.
Yes.
So Instagram at Curious Gata. And then on LinkedIn at Catalina Peña. And I don't usually use Twitter, but you can find me at Curious Gata's _ as well. And if you want to learn more about Catalyst Creation, you can go to catalystcreation.co. And then you can find out more there to see if we can help your ERGs or like any university that you're a part of or organization.
That's amazing. Awesome. Oh my gosh. Thank you so much, Gata. This was so much fun.
Thank you so much.
That was such a cool episode.
Yeah, that was so nice. Just learning about her experience and what brought her to Catalyst Creation. It's really, really cool. You know, fellow Afro-Latina, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and I really appreciate what she said. I mean, she said so many cool things. I think pivot is such an important word right now, right? Mm-hmm. Like I hear that mm-hmm. word everywhere. And she gave really great tips on how to pivot and just like how to write your own job description. I thought that was pretty cool too.
Yeah, that was great.
I'm just really inspired, motivated to just kind of continue to think outside the box.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I just want to remind our listeners to don't forget to follow us and tell a friend or two or three on Instagram. We are at Rocio Mercedes. Our email is rociomercedes@gmail.com. Hit us up. Hit us up on our Patreon, patreon.com/rociomercedes. We would really appreciate the support so we could keep thriving and continuing to record these episodes. Yeah, we love y'all and want to keep doing more and more.
Yeah, and don't forget, if you haven't done so, to write a review. We need some dope reviews on Apple. And keep downloading, and we'll keep creating.
Yep.
Bye.
Peace out, y'all. Bye.